Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 2nd, 1998. The fireside room this morning is Christian Sharon. Today's session number is 98-2, and it's titled Worship and Ethics, the Hidden Language of Time. Let's listen in.
This is session 2 of Worship and Ethics, the Hidden Language of Time, and I'm Chris Sharon. Thank you all for coming. We'll have a intimate discussion as we did last time, I'm sure. The rest of the sessions, including today, I'm going to begin with a meditation from the book Practicing Our Faith that raises at least one angle on the particular hidden language that we're talking about. And today, the hidden language we're talking about is time. So I'm going to just read the beginning of Dorothy Bass's chapter, Keeping Sabbath, which has all sorts of suggestions and thoughts about timekeeping, both for Jews and for Christians in her chapter. But the beginning raises questions about our culture and about time. Welcome. We're just getting started.
We lost track of the time.
That's fine. Find a comfortable chair. Make sure you get some of the pads. I'm just starting with a meditation from the Practicing Our Faith book, the summer theme book, from the chapter Keeping Sabbath. How often people today cry out in exasperation or despair, "I just don't have enough time. There's so much to do. Earn a living, fulfill a vocation, nurture relationships, care for dependents, get some exercise, clean the house. Moreover, we hope to maintain sanity while doing all this, and to keep growing as faithful and loving people at the same time. We are finite, and the demands seem too great, the time too short. Those of us who feel time's pressure have lots of company in this society. In a surprise bestseller of 1991, The Overworked American, economist Juliet Shore reported that work hours and stress are up, and sleep and family time are down for all classes of employed Americans. Wives working outside the home return to find a second shift of housework awaiting them. Husbands add overtime or second jobs to their schedules. Single parents stretch in so many different directions that sometimes they can't manage. Simultaneously, all are bombarded by messages that urge them to spend more, and so ultimately work more, to keep their homes cleaner, standards keep rising, and to improve themselves as lovers, investors, parents, or athletes. Supposedly, to make all this possible, grocery stores stay open all night long, and entertainment options are available around the clock. We live, says Juliet Shore, in an economy and society that are demanding too much from people. What's a person to do? U.S. culture has some ready answers. Quality time with your kids is the answer for parents. An exercise machine that reduces stress and burns off fat in only 20 minutes three times a week is the answer for overwrought and overweight. What you need is a good night's sleep or a vacation is the answer one friend offers to another. Each of these answers has value. Yet our circumstances require a stronger response, and we are too caught up in the whirlwind of our lives to devise one. In this situation, the historic practice of setting aside one day a week for rest and for worship promises peace to those who embrace it. Whether we know the term Sabbath or not, we harried citizens of late modernity yearn for the reality. We need Sabbath, even though we doubt we have time for it. A provocative opening to her chapter, and it raises questions that I hope we'll dig further into as we go into the session today. The proposal for conversation this week to get at the question of worship and ethics, a question that could be asked very many ways, is this proposal: in order for liturgy to form us well in the practices of faith, we must learn the hidden languages of worship. That's my proposal that I'm using to get into the discussion this week. And in the first session yesterday, I parsed a little bit each of these four underlying pieces to set a larger context for the question. What is liturgy? Why do we worry about what forms us? What are practices, and what are the hidden languages? What I felt both from my own reflection and from evaluations was that I didn't spend very much time on this question of ethics. Why does this concern about the hidden languages of time and space and silence and gesture in worship, what do those have to do with ethics? Especially ethics in the way that we normally talk about it. And when I asked people yesterday, as you remember, what association do we have with ethics, it's usually right or wrong, do and don't, those sorts of associations. And so, just to start with, I wanted to quickly say something about why ask questions about ethics and the way I'm asking questions about ethics. And I think it will lead into the discussion of time in our culture, because this leads us into the question of what forms us in our society. I think by raising the question the way we did yesterday of ethics as do and don't, right and wrong, we raised the everyday ethics in our society, sort of pragmatic ethics. What should I do? That's the concern. Or what should other people be doing? And there, in ethical discourse historically, there's two versions of that. What is right, which means following the rules, the sort of fancy word for that is deontological ethics. And the other version of that is what is to be achieved, focusing on what our goal is. If you're going to be a well-mannered child, then you have to sit up at the table and use your napkin, chew with your mouth closed. Those are all things that we say to people because we want to achieve a goal, a well-mannered child. So that's in traditional language, teleological ethics, focusing on the telos, the end. But I'm arguing in this class that Christian ethics, especially today when our lives feel uncertain, there's great sort of spiritual upheaval in our country, that we need to pay attention to this question, to the I, and not only to the I, because I think this way of asking questions leads to a very highly individualistic sense of ethics. And I think if we, as we talk this week, we'll realize we're formed together socially in very powerful ways. And so I want to ask the question of formation. Because of who we are, we do this. And I think that's a very biblical way of talking about ethics. If you think about the metaphor throughout the New Testament about the tree bearing fruit, a good tree bears good fruit, and a bad tree bears bad fruit. And so asking the question about the tree is a way to ask the question of formation. And I think especially when we ask that question in the way that I'm trying to ask it, how these broader themes like time and space and worship shape us, then it's not just what should I do, but how are we together formed in certain ways. And so it's a communal way of asking about ethics. And I think that it's a way of talking about ethics that could be summed up really simply in these three words: doing shapes being. And so it's a way of talking about ethics that's concerned about practices. And that's the theme of our summer, practicing our faith. What are the practices that guide us in the Christian life? So I want to ask critical questions about our doing as a way to think, well, what is shaping us? And I just wrote down some categories. And I'm not saying that any of these should or shouldn't form us. They all rightly, I think, form us because they're all aspects of our lives, aspects of our society. Home, the most formative early place where we're shaped. School, most of us spend at least 12 and oftentimes many more years in school. So it's an incredibly powerful formation of how we do things. Work, many of us spend the majority of our adult life in various jobs, and so that shapes us very strongly. Arts and media are extremely powerful in an age that's visual and oral and not so much the written word. And combined with that is the market. The advertising budget of corporations is larger than the entire amount of money spent on schools in our society. So there's a powerful educational formative effect through the market and what it concerns, what it tries to teach us about what to buy. Government, and then I put church last, but I hope it's not last. That's one of my central concerns, is in this society where so much, so powerfully is shaping what we do, then it's important for us to ask, well, how is the church in intentional ways shaping us, shaping the tree that we are, so that the fruit in our lives, the practices in our lives, are practices that embody the faith and share the faith with others. So this way of thinking about ethics isn't the sort of knee-jerk way we think about ethics often in our culture, but I think it's a helpful way now in our present time in our society to think about ethics. So with that as a sort of lead-in, what I wanted to do is brainstorm together about some of the ways that time is used in our culture. What's a way to say this? In what ways do we experience particular ideas or practices of time in our culture? And I have a couple just to throw out to get started, to give you a sense of what I have in mind. There's some cliches that you might hear in our society about time that give you a sense of what our culture thinks of time. Time is money. Be on time. We're a very prompt culture. You're wasting your time. You go somewhere and you have the time of your life. There's all sorts of cliches that if you mine beneath them, you realize there's powerful modes of living in our society that are embodied in that cliche. So I just wanted to take a moment and brainstorm together what we think, and I don't want to say our culture is just a monolithic culture. There's very diverse aspects of our culture. So I think, say, if you went to the Hispanic district in San Francisco, the Mission District, you would find a different sensibility about time than you would if you went to a different neighborhood in San Francisco where upper-class professional business people live. But let's just take a moment together and reflect about time in our culture and what that evokes.
It comes in two parts, work and leisure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It has two names.
Strictly divided.
There you go.
Do you think you're allowed to do, to manage time one way in work and another way in leisure? Or does the way you're supposed to spend your time have a similarity between at work and when you're at leisure?
I have the sense that, let's see, looking at my kids growing up and me growing up, that, and so I think it reflects me too, that their time was much more organized than my time was. And I think probably my leisure time was much more organized.
Today?
Today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So in that way, it's starting to resemble work, maybe.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Efficiency, right? You're supposed to get as much into the time that you have, right? Get as much out of the time and you can, whether it's leisure, you know, and you're a place you want to do everything that it offers,
mm-hmm.
or at work, you should have your calendar all arranged so you can maximize your time.
Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about that is that, like he described there, people are working longer. If we're so efficient, it seems like that should be getting shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And the more technology we invent to save time, it seems the more we work,
mm-hmm.
which is very odd.
There's more to do.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing that kind of reflects both of those is that time for us means accrual or accumulation of something, whether it's money or goods or services or experiences. Yeah, it's about accumulating something for ourselves. Then the more time we have, the more we have to gather or accrue.
That's good. So we get phrases like, was your time productive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's no such thing as just, you know, wasting time. It's not valid.
Time is so interesting here at Holden. We hear from so many people how they love to come because they're forced to stop. Their cell phones stop working, their pagers can't reach them, the newspaper doesn't come daily, they don't. And so there's a sense for those who come for a short period of time that there is, there's space to breathe and rest.
Yeah.
And you're not expected to do. I mean, everything is optional except worship. But one who lives here finds that time is highly regimented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The bells ring.
Bells ring all the time.
Sign up for loons.
You're waiting. Yeah. Right now, I am so pressed by my leisure. I have a loon for 5 days. I have to get my rug done today. And everyone talks about, this is supposed to be Zen-like. And the first thing I thought of is, what I get done on that rug today is how long that rug's going to be, period. I mean, I have to be off that loon. So suddenly, my leisure time is now pressing me. How can I get that leisure time in? Mm-hmm. So even in a place like this, you experience time differently.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost an obligation to serve yourself, to be well-rounded. You know, I mean, amongst people who are more thoughtful or more educated or something, you feel like, I must have this opportunity to make myself a more rounded person, and these things present themselves, and if I don't take advantage, if I don't go to the session, if I don't do this, then I am cheating myself of the riches the world has to offer. It becomes work.
Self-development. I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and go to a school that's related to the Carter Center, and so every once in a while I hear funny anecdotes about Jimmy Carter. And during his presidency, he was concerned about exactly what you're saying, developing himself culturally. So when he was in his office on off moments, he would listen to tapes of abbreviated classics with commentary. So he would like hear 5 minutes of some important classical piece and then a brief description of its history, just to sort of continually prompt himself and make himself more conversational in areas he didn't feel he was conversational.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I mean, he did it for certain reasons that we can understand, but I think it's something that many of us do in different ways. It may be the pursuit of a certain sort of body, and so we see images of that, and then we spend our time trying to work towards that, or maybe music, or...
I was just at Luther College in Iowa 3 weeks ago. The choral conductor there just celebrated his 50th year.
Yes.
I lived with him for 3 years while I was in school. I taught there for 3 years under him. I was the B choral conductor. So I got to know him very well. He's a guy who does not have leisure time.
Huh.
He considers every moment to be crucial to what he's doing.
Huh.
And I've been dogged by that model my entire life,
mm-hmm.
from knowing him. The reason he, you know, I mean, in my mind, the reason he has succeeded in being so successful at being so wonderful for that college and recruiting all these students, being so important in the lives of people, is because he has devoted every moment of his life. And the guy's the most incredible insomniac. And he always has got a stack of yellow pieces of paper right by his bed, and he turns on his lamp and he writes whatever's in his mind and he throws it in a stack on the floor, goes to sleep, wakes up, writes another one. And the next morning he spreads them all out on his desk, he deals with them. There is not, sleep is not restful.
Yeah.
But he has functioned at a high level for 50 years. He's 75 years old and has no intention of stepping down. So when you have that model, you wonder, what kind of a schmo am I? You know, how come I'm not doing that?
Yeah,
how come I'm not accomplishing that much? It's worse when you ask yourself.
No, I know. And then there's a sense of time passing in your life.
Right.
You know, your life... being more than half over, I guess this is the mid-age thing.
Yeah.
By December 5, I know.
And then you see, I see people like Christian and Sonia, and I think, what they've accomplished in their short period of time, and I haven't done anything, you know. Which leads me to my other thing about time, is this whole introduction of quantity versus quality time in relationships.
Yeah.
So that now we've, in a way, kind of scheduled relationships to be productive. I can't spend a whole lot of time with you, honey. So the hour we've got, it is just,
let's share.
Let's make a moment. Let's, you know, let's affect one another's lives in some deep way, because this is what we have. And there, just that sense of being with another person.
Yeah.
When you're not self-consciously making it matter.
Yeah.
So it's come into how we are with one another too. And I think especially with parenting, you know, that we're told we really can do everything, have full careers, have develop ourselves, have recreational time, and raise children, if we arrange to have these moments with the children that will imprint them for life.
Well, I find it really interesting when I was at, well, I'm not on maternity leave now, but in the beginning when Isaiah was like 2 weeks old and I was having my first days where I was actually home from 9 to 5 by myself. And suddenly, what was a good day was if I could figure out how to get him to be happy in his bouncy chair, so I got the bed made and I got a shower in, and oh wow, look how good I'm doing now. Now I'm gonna write a thank you note, and like if my time could be productive or regimented or have a normal schedule. So I actually ate lunch at lunchtime and I sat down at the table that, you know, and instead of thinking, oh well, this is all my time. My whole time is just to sit with Isaiah, and if the bed's made, who cares? And if it's just this whole productivity or use of time. I need to have something to report when Chris gets home, even though he could care less if I had to report back.
Well, I've done the same things. You know, Martin will walk in the door. I will have to announce to him everything I've accomplished because, and then he will say to me, because he's better about this than I am, he'll say, honey, I believe you have earned the air you breathe today. And I think there's a, can we get theological?
Yes.
Please. I think there is a piece of this under here, this deep sense of undeserving that we have, and that really there is no gift. And time is not gift, air is not gift, life is not gift. And so each day, it's the quest for me is to say, did I earn, did I deserve what I've been given today? Mm-hmm. I have pangs of guilt if at the end of a day I have nothing to show for. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, maybe I should be in therapy, but I think it's something, I don't think it's theological. Yeah. I think it's just the deep human resistance to give and to let it go and to say, I'm not the dog that barks the sun up. I'm not, you know, I can rest and time will continue to unfold. But, you know, I miss Bible study. I slept till 9:30 this morning. And so now I come in full of guilt. All this day has passed, you know.
That's why you look great. Yeah.
But I think there's something in there. What do we have to show for the time? And can we double task?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many things can we do at once? So again, we lose a kind of mindfulness or focus or presence because, in fact, I can, you know, have quality time with my children while I'm cleaning the kitchen.
Right.
Which is what I do. I say, roll your chairs in here.
Right.
Let's talk while I'm cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
I do that.
I was reading a book. I forget his name. Anyway, famous Vietnamese Buddhist philosopher. He was telling about a friend of his who's not at all Buddhist, who said that he said to Thich Nhat Hanh, he said, I always was dividing up, okay, this is the time for my kids, and this is dinner today, and this is the time for work, and he said, and I had this little time left for myself, so this is going to be time with myself. And then he said, at one point he made a change and decided, No, all of that is time for myself. The time with my kids is time for myself. The time I'm working is time for myself. The time I'm sleeping is time for myself. And then he said once he had made that shift in, just that shift in thinking, his whole concept of his world changed. I thought that was interesting.
And what if you said all that time was actually for others, the time for yourself was for others? Mm-hmm. You could switch it that way.
You could switch it that way too. I think he did kind of a both. Like he realized that his time with others was good for himself also, and good for them. It was really interesting.
We have a little instrument that we bought from REI that has a magnifying glass on the top and a little kind of pincers thing underneath. And you put it on your skin and look to, you know, if a wood tick has gotten on you. And then it pulls it off, and with the magnifying glass, you can make sure that there's nothing in it. And we call that tick not on.
I'll never forget the
magnifying. Well, I'd like to
move along.
On that note. Let's take the example though of a Vietnamese Buddhist monk who's become a sensation in the United States, mm-hmm. and raise the question of what is it about the character of our society that creates this sort of relentlessness that wearies us, yet we can't escape the fact that we feel judged by that style of using time, and that creates the desire in people for something completely different, which I think is at the heart of the embrace of Buddhism in the United States. Mm-hmm. The very different worldview and understanding of time and mindfulness and attention. And for many, in my very cursory reading of American Buddhist sort of sociological studies of the introduction of Buddhism to the United States, one of the most attractive things about Buddhism to Americans isn't the actual religious doctrines of Buddhism, but the religious practices of Buddhism. And I think it's exactly because of the, and this is going into my particular interpretation of American history, but the rootedness in Protestant Puritan Calvinism that set an ethos for the United States and the Protestant work ethic and the sort of popularization of that through Ben Franklin and his Poor Richard's Almanac and the cliches that he coined or published that still live in our conversations and set our minds and have surfaced in our conversation today. But one of the very interesting questions that this practices book raises is if we go back into the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition that our Christian tradition comes out of, what do we find? We find that, interestingly, Jesus wasn't shaped by Calvin and the Protestant ethic. There's a whole different world there, a different understanding of time, and that in our own deep tradition in the Christian church and in the various practices of worship in different religious communities over time, and in the patterns of worship over time, we see that there's something different in that tradition that can give us grace now. So I wanted to take just a minute and look at a couple of distinctive things about Christian patterning of time in worship. And then in conclusion, we'll talk about how that understanding of time can influence our following of some of these practices. Let me do a quick erase job. While I'm erasing,
you can do two things at once, right?
Yeah. I'll just sort of be mindful of erasing the word.
About the idea of timelessness.
Timelessness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Eternity, would that be another way of saying it?
Oh, okay.
Without time.
Yeah.
It's one of the...
Is that
it's one of the things.
Nirvana, but you reach a place of timelessness, as it is time stood still.
Yeah. Do you mean outside of our lives or an experience within our lives where we
mountain,
feel...
Mountaintop experiences.
Yeah. Where you feel like time stopped.
Yeah.
Have you experienced that?
Yeah, I think I have.
Yeah, in what sort of situation?
Oh, I can't really specifically say, but there have been points along my life that, you know, stand out and...
Yeah.
And you sort of live on those for the rest of the time.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah. So there's a... There's a sort of relationship between an experience like that that really energizes you in a certain way.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time.
Or those kind of kairos times where it isn't that time stops, it's that time gets big. Mm-hmm. Instead of marching along like this, it's sort of just so.
I guess one poet called it. In the morning mist, two lovers kissed, and the woods were still. Huh?
Yes, in the morning mist, two lovers kissed, and the woods were still. Still. Huh? I love that.
I forgot.
Everything is.
That description of sort of timeless moments is one way that religious experience, personal or communal religious experience, is often talked about. And I think it's one of the goals of meditation, whether it's Christian meditation, historic practices of Christian meditation or Eastern meditation, is to sort of, it moves you outside of yourself. I mean, in a sense, the word ecstasy is talking about what you're talking about. You sort of lose yourself, move outside of yourself, stand outside of yourself, right? Outside of time. The mystics, I'm thinking of Meister Eckhart, but there are many others in the Western tradition who have really unbelievable descriptions of their experience of that sort of timelessness.
Thank you. You elaborated.
No, but I think it's an aspect of time in the Christian tradition I wasn't planning to cover, but it's very rich and important, so I'm glad that you raised it. The broadest context for time I could think of that marks Christian worship and our life is the way in which we think about all of time, from the creation of the universe to the... although it's talked about in poetic language, the end times, when the new creation will come. And in the Christian confession, Jesus marks the center of that, the transition, the sort of fullness of this beginning, and yet not the conclusion of everything, but the announcement of the conclusion. So at the very center of everything is Jesus' life and death and resurrection. But also, if we listen to the witness of John's Gospel and other texts in Scripture, Colossians, we know that Jesus was also at the beginning. The world was created through him. And then if we read Revelations and some of the Pauline material, we also see that Jesus' own proclamation in the Gospels that Jesus will come again, the ancient cry Maranatha, come Lord Jesus, and this end time is also marked by Jesus. So our entire experience of grand historical time is marked by Jesus. Then the day, week, and year, liturgically speaking, throughout the entire history of the church have been marked by Jesus as well. The ancient pattern of the day developed slowly. Early on, some Christian communities just adopted the Jewish practice of praying three times a day, and they would pray the Lord's Prayer three times a day. Other communities developed different patterns, but over the 2,000 years of Christian history, one of the most powerful and most widespread practices of ordering the day is an ordering of morning and evening prayer. Morning prayer that greets the rising sun and gives thanks for the day is prayer of gratitude and thanksgiving for what God has created And really, as a remembrance of the resurrection, the rising sun isn't too hard to imagine as a symbol of the resurrection, the sun coming out of the darkness and shedding light on the day. And then at the end of the day, penitential or sort of reflective service, admitting what was done that day and asking God for forgiveness and trusting in the mercy and in the power of Jesus that will keep one in God's care for the evening. So that patterning of the day is a Christian worship practice based on Jesus' life. The patterning of the week, having the Sunday worship be the day of resurrection, marks for Christians a weekly remembrance and celebration of that historical act at the center of all time. And so it's at the center of our week. And on the back of our Sunday worship bulletins this summer, there's a description of early Christian worship from the year 150 from Justin Martyr in Rome. And at the end of that, he gives an explanation. He says the Christians meet on the day of the sun, on the first day of the week. And it was also called the eighth day of the week, the day beyond the week. So in a sense, Sunday for the early Christians was an experience of timelessness, an experience of being not on the earth, but in heaven. Actually being a part of the worshiping community was a transfer into another realm, into a realm out of time. And so they called it the eighth day. And sometimes early baptismal fonts have eight signs as an indication of that. When you go into the font and die and rise again, you're rising out of time into this reign of God. And then the year, the Christian year, is also marked by Jesus' life. The earliest church focused on the resurrection as the center, so the celebration of Easter was the center of the year. And the early sort of three important moments of the church year were Epiphany, which we've sort of marginalized in response to Christmas in our society, but early on, Epiphany was the main celebration of the manifestation of Jesus, of the incarnation, and they told the various stories of Jesus coming, not only the infancy narratives, but the narratives about Jesus as a child going to the temple, and about the Magi coming to Jesus, various stories, the first miracle at the wedding at Cana. All of those were the ways that the Gospels told about Jesus coming. And then Easter being the celebration of the death and resurrection, the victory. And then the third major celebration was the, it was a combination of Pentecost and Ascension, Jesus sending his Spirit on the church and then ascending, and those were together. So there were three central moments marking the life of Jesus that marked the year for the early church, and they still do today in much more elaborate form. We've developed seasons that lead up to Easter and go away from Easter, seasons that lead up to Christmas and Epiphany and afterwards. But there are obviously other things about our Christian life that mark our time, and so I welcome other thoughts that you have about the ways that we mark time. This idea of timelessness or a moment out of time was one.
Something I don't like about your diagram,
this one,
it's linear.
Yeah.
You know, and as you get toward the end, then you think, what you haven't accomplished yet.
Right.
You cram more and more stuff in before the end. And the thing I like about the liturgical year is that it always repeats itself.
Yeah.
If you didn't fit it in this year, you might do it next year. Right. The coming year. Right. This, the cyclical thing, I find very, very comforting. You know, you mentioned that in contemporary society, Christmas has displaced Epiphany.
Right.
And we in our family have kind of gotten away from the present thing pretty radically at Christmas time, because it was, we see it causing such anxiety.
Yeah.
Because Christmas Eve is the end of time.
Right.
You've got to have all your
presents time.
wrapped and spend all that money and and then it's all over.
Yeah.
You unwrap the presents in 15 minutes and you throw the paper in the fireplace and it's dumb and it's crazy. It's just crazy. I would like to return to Epiphany. I think that'd be a real good idea.
Yeah. We've done that in our family. We've taken Epiphany back, and we do it liturgically in this community in a number of ways. We have one service on the eve of Epiphany when we go around to every home. You'll see these chalk marks above the doors. And sanctify each home again as a place of hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have that, and then on Epiphany, we have the Eucharist that ends with a huge bonfire. It's kind of an English tradition out there where we bring our Christmas trees and boughs and we burn them and pray for the nations as the sparks go up.
Mm-hmm.
But our family, we brought that here because our family found just what you were saying, there's just disappointment somehow. You couldn't make Christmas not at some point be disappointing. And the gift, the giving of gifts is so central to Epiphany. So we do give gifts. We give them on the 6th and we give fewer. And if you live out there, everything's on sale. But that almost feels like sort of like a countercultural, I gotcha thing. If you walk in and something, someone has spent $40 on, you buy for $20.
Yeah.
And it's almost like undermining the system that wants to take over your holiday.
One of my brothers has had the experience, I didn't know this as a child, but he had the experience, and there were four of us in the family, and he always felt like he got the worst present of everybody. Mm-hmm. And he usually broke it by the end of the day also. And so Christmas gifts for him was really a traumatic thing, and they now have a child and they're struggling with what to do with that. And they're not Christians, so they don't have this Epiphany alternative. What they have come to is to do something more along the lines of giving gifts of, which is interesting to say, giving gifts of time to each other, doing something for someone else. And that's what they want to focus on. It'll be interesting to see how that shapes in the future, but giving time as a present.
That connects with the time thing that we do in worship that I wanted to bring up, which is how we mark the personal life cycle in worship, the times, the moments in people's lives where meaning really coalesces, that baptisms and affirmations of faith and rites of passage. Mm-hmm. We've lost some of that, but it seems to me that those would be excellent worship liturgical times to say, you know, the anniversary of baptisms, weddings, funerals. Mm-hmm. That's a way we mark time liturgically.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow say, by marking the growth and movement of an individual life, that is a communal marking.
Mm-hmm. It raises the question of how much time we're willing to spend in worship. One of my textbooks for the worship class I taught this past spring suggested that, and this isn't unique to him, but if you take a moment to think about where you spend your time, then that's an indication of what you think about what's important. And the congregation that Sonia and I are a member of, I think would fall over and die if worship went over an hour. And so no matter what they have to do, worship is an hour. And if that service has baptisms, then other things are left aside. And if we're going to take seriously the sort of richness of honoring people's lives and take, in a sense, take back some of the rites of passage from our society instead of a rite of passage to adolescents being a driver's license or turning 21 so you can buy beer, have some sort of renewal of confirmation or other ritual practices that would honor that transition, then time has to be spent. An economic metaphor, maybe I shouldn't use that, but it requires attention and time. And I think that the Bible study this morning was really a rich example, because in order to throw a feast for guests, one must give up other things to attend to that task. And I think that at a deep level, I'm resistant to some of the things that I think would be good, because I know how much time it requires and I have to attend to it in that way. And it also requires thoughtfulness ahead of time. It's very difficult to do something well for another person without the sort of advanced work, time spent ahead of time, in order to be gracious to them and for it to go well. So, I mean, it's in a sense a very basic level of practicing. We have to take care in our rehearsal so that when we get to the performance of whatever it is, an offer of hospitality, an offer of a worship service, an offer of a performance of music, that it's done well and is given well. So,
I talked to a pastor who was up here who's radically changed, a Lutheran pastor, maybe like he's Christ alone, changed worship completely on with this generation, whatever that is. They are willing to spend 1 hour, but not two. Not an hour for Christian ed and an hour for worship. Mm-hmm. So he has collapsed the two and has done, he had a word for it. I can't remember the word, it wasn't efficiency, but it's like an efficiency liturgy, where if you come, it will all happen. So you'll have, the Bible study is the sermon. It's a combined Christian education and liturgy. Well, it's just about, I mean, you can hardly tell it's the liturgy that we've come to, that we've inherited. And I asked him, I said, who told you that these people have only 1 hour? I mean, did they come up and say, we won't give you 2 hours? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, we tried. The church bought a latte machine, and they tried having lattes and espresso drinks between the Christian ed and the worship. But he said, no, I just watched their behavior. They would do one or the other, and that sometimes they would alternate weeks. This week we'll do Christian ed, this week we'll... I'm just trying to imagine what's going on in their lives. What is so pressing? I don't know what it is, but I... And he says, well, what's more important, you know, keeping your precious liturgy or bringing people into a life with Christ? And that was very challenging to me, because I wanted to say, keeping the precious liturgy, you know? But... maybe I'm wrong on that.
Yeah.
I spent several seasons singing in temples, Jewish temples. Mm-hmm. And one year in particular, I did everything. I did all the holidays. They have a lot of holidays. And this was an old European-based temple on the north side of Chicago. It was older people. They were... immigrants, they were more devout than the younger temples that I worked at later on up on the North Shore. And they still did all the holidays. And I subsequently took a course at the seminary in Chicago about the roots of Christian liturgy, mm-hmm. where these various holidays they celebrated were explained to me, and I got a book about them. And they were based on things that were no longer... They were based on the year, the agrarian year in Israel. And I went, and they would put up booths in their yards for the Feast of Booths and all the various things that would happen. I remember during this time I went and visited a friend who lived in Brooklyn, and there were booths up along the street in Brooklyn. Because people were still celebrating holidays, yet at the same time, this temple was getting emptier and emptier. The only time that most people showed up was the high holidays. Yeah. And they said, well, these holidays, I mean, the basic year doesn't make sense to these people anymore. They live in the suburbs of Chicago. They don't herd sheep in Israel anymore. And I thought a lot about that, because I sometimes, in my work as a church musician, I found that we're working with a calendar or with landmarks that don't make sense to the people that belong to the church. Mm-hmm.
who are supposed to be making sense of it. And so they do certain things out of habit or practice, but it doesn't have meaning to them. And I've wondered about a liturgy, about a calendar based on what really happens in our lives. You know, an urban church year or something. I don't know. I have nothing more defined to say than that, but I've thought about that.
Well, working in the inner city church in Oakland, there were a lot of modifications of the church year that occurred. Kwanzaa was a big one. Christmas was there. But the Sunday after Christmas was Kwanzaa Day, Kwanzaa celebration. The month of February was African American History Month. All of the Sundays spoke something about the history of the African American people. So, yeah, I think there is, you know, a cultural modification that has happened throughout that time, like that.
Yeah, and I see that in Chicago in the African American communities, but if you don't live in an African American community, we have a different.
Yeah.
I don't want to co-opt their holidays. They don't make sense to me.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, my family farms, and so the Jewish liturgical year would make sense, or some version of it might make sense to them if they were religious. You know, they start working hard when the frost stops, and they stop working when the killing frost hits, and they would. A year would make sense, but for me living on the south side of Chicago, that year didn't make any sense.
I think actually that can be a very helpful thing. One of the stark tensions in Christianity is the relationship between the church and the culture that the church lives in, because of course the church is in that culture, but the question is how it negotiates its identity and relationship to that culture. And I think if the church, there's the old cliche, the church that marries the spirit of the age doesn't make it to the next generation. And I think there's a wisdom in that the church has known, that it can't be simply the culture, or it loses itself and has nothing to say to the culture or to the world. The sort of ancient symbolic idea of the world as the place that Christ came to redeem, but that the church is the world redeemed in the world, unredeemed. And so the church has to be in the world, but have something distinctive to say to the world. So there's a way in which having a bunch of people marching down Auburn Avenue in Atlanta with a cross and waving palms and singing on a Sunday morning as people are trying to drive here and there makes a witness to the city that something different is happening here. These people are ordering the time of their week, their day, to do something quite odd. And so I think that not only do the churches who become too much like culture lose something to say to the world, but the people who become Christian lose something in their becoming Christian. Yeah.
I think Advent is a perfect example of that. There's been this, you read more and more articles of give it up. I mean, give Advent up. The truth is everybody's doing Christmas. The people in your parish are doing Christmas. They're having their Christmas parties. Those pre-Christmas weeks are Christmas. Give it up, church. Find another penitential time or another waiting time or longing time or expectation time. And it's those articles that make me more fervently dig in my heels and say, are we going to live in some way counterculturally? Are we going to say somehow as a people, while everyone is celebrating a midwinter feast of materialism that deep down has no grounding in the gift of the incarnation, how are we going to train up a tree, raise a people to say that very feast of materialism is proof enough of the deep longing for healing and meaning and the ache for hope in the bones of people? It seems to me that Advent could become such a subversive and powerful witness to a world that can't even name its longing. That there's a whole culture feeding its longing for God and its longing for peace with shopping. Mm-hmm. And if the church could say, I mean, if I were really a bold pastor, I'd say to my parish, a moratorium on all gifts this year. I mean, forget it. Let it go. And figure out what we're longing for, what we're waiting for. Would people, would the church begin to say, we actually have something to give the world? We have a... Is it too arrogant to say that Advent is a time when people who follow Jesus on behalf of a world that doesn't know what it's longing for will ache for others? That we will be a witness of being pulled toward something. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I fight it in my own family. We don't put a tree up until Christmas. Mm-hmm. We don't decorate for Christmas mm-hmm. until Christmas. And my children are the only people, you know, don't have a tree and it's not red and white. We don't decorate with red and white. We decorate with white or red and green. We decorate with white and gold at Christmas. Yeah. And I think they're coming to see now that there is power in moving against the stream, but it isn't easy. Mm-hmm. So the Kwanzaa thing, frankly, it was begun in the 1950s in the United States. It strikes me as the same as putting a flag in a sanctuary. Have Kwanzaa celebrations, but I don't...
That was my feeling too. But...
And African American History Week, where, I would say, when do you read the Exodus text in scriptures? That's, mm-hmm. I mean, when does the year, when does Christ call to your history and speak, you know, a word of judgment and a word of redemption? Mm-hmm. Instead of, who came up with February as African American History Month? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe I'm just so stuck on this that I'll never get out of it, but Kwanzaa feels like a huge capitulation to a culture that wants to lift itself above the reign of God. Mm-hmm.
And
every culture does it. I mean, I get sick of Norwegian things. All of that ethnicity stuff that just sometimes drives me. I have no ethnic, that's my problem. I don't know, there's, my speech.
Yeah, but there's a way in which the Christian ordering, or ordering of time through the life of Jesus is a deep shaping and ordering pattern for our lives. And if we listen too much to culture, then what we're drawn into most deeply is idolatry, because we take something that's less than the most important or the deepest truth about our lives as the truth. And we can do that in mundane ways by celebrating X, Y, or Z celebration on Sunday. And so it's not so much a question of whether we honor our heritage, I don't think, because we need to do those things, or to honor our mothers, or to honor our country. But the relationship between those things, which aren't the center of our identity as Christians, and the things that form us, the things that we do over time together that form us as Christians, that needs to be thought about carefully. And one of the issues, that one of the rubs, I think, between our culture and the experience of the church is the power of our culture with the money that's spent on media and advertising and the market encouraging us to buy things. There's an incredible assault on our consciousness all the time about what we should honor and think and spend our time doing. And so without, at least I'm arguing, without consciously thinking about how we spend our time forming ourselves as Christians in the life of Jesus each day and each week and over the course of the year, then we don't have a resistance to what our society says we should be. And with this sort of experience of time and paying attention to how we do that in worship, then I think we're shaped in ways that can unpack these practices in rich ways. for instance, the question of hospitality that we're talking about this morning, if we simply do Kwanzaa, then we're saying, well, we'll be hospitable to African Americans who celebrate Kwanzaa. So there's a certain necessity of exclusion to that holiday, and it has two sides to it. One side is we're celebrating ourselves in a society that has oppressed us and not celebrated us, and that's very important.
Yes.
It's very important. It's central to the gospel that each person baptized is a child of God, equal, neither Jew nor Greek. But the fundamental notion of hospitality that we learn through all participating, say, you could take the Eucharist, for example, all coming to the table together and taking the time for everyone to come to the table, even if it's a packed church and, you know, goes on and on, people just keep coming down the aisle. Instead of impatience, there should be celebration that the time is taken for all to come to the table, because in the spending of that time, we learn the hospitality of welcoming all. And that can be a way to make a connection between the Christian ordering of time and the exclusions in terms of hospitality that happen, and ways to address that. So I guess I'm never going to say we should make a complete distinction between culture and the church, or we should collapse the two. It's a tension that keeps chasing us around, and I think our conversation today has been an example of what we can learn together when we dig into that tension and try and see how to live more faithfully. We're about at the end of our time, and so I hope the conversation will continue, but thanks for coming and for the richness of the discussion. And if you're willing to, I have a brief evaluation that I invite you to fill out. You're certainly not required to, but if you choose to, it will be to my benefit. And I have little pencils and evaluation forms, which I'll just set over here. You can grab one and fill it out on your way out if you wish. And if you're exhausted or excited and want to just reflect and talk more, then you're welcome to do that.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah.
There was a person who was here interviewing a village pastor position.